He tells me about how happy he is to be out of Hoboken, but how he does miss the bars. It's all so easy, so familiar. I know how to talk to him. I know how to get the best of him. The night is slowing down and the crowd is thinning. John was a hallucination. I fainted because I didn't eat, and I thought I saw him because the only other time I've fainted was when he came back in Nashua. Something about being back with Carrig, leaving the gallery with him, the way he hails a cab as if he lives here, which he does, which is what John said he would do, which he didn't. This feels like life to me. And everything about John, it feels like it was holding me back from life, trapping me down to the fucking art I make. All the eyes, only the eyes, always trying to figure out what John was thinking, what was going on behind those eyes. And now I'm free. I'm in a cab with Carrig. Carrig, who showed up. Carrig, who says he was living in Hoboken all these years, where they play Billy Joel in all the bars.
You probably don't ever go there, he says.
No, I respond. But that doesn't mean I have anything against Billy Joel. He's E.T. with the heart light on, and I'm embarrassed for him. How clear it is that he still wants me. But then it's nice to be wanted so openly, craved like pizza. I could do this. I can picture us at Billy Joel. I can picture this whole other life where I'm wearing all my lily dresses and I have this guy who worships me. He nudges me.
Why are you smiling?
I'm just trying to remember. You didn't want to live in the city when we were younger, did you?
No, he says. But I knew you did.
He opens the door of the cab for me. Thank you. And the door of his building. Thank you. And he holds the elevator. Thank you. And then he opens the door of his bedroom. Thank you. And then he opens sliding doors, wide doors, miracle glass doors that lead out to his terrace. Thank you. He stands there looking out at the city.
What do you think? He asks,
not meeting my gaze, because he doesn't have to look at me. I know it all. I know he did this for me. Moved here. Worked. Earned. This is all because he doesn't think he's good enough. When I move toward him for a kiss, for his hands, he doesn't push me away or run. He pulls me closer. His arms wrap around me, two doors closing.
John. 73 hours have passed since I ran out of the gallery. She is eerily quiet, not wishing anyone a happy birthday, not posting a selfie. It was a mistake to go see her, and I want to know that she's okay, that she's alive. It's 10:27 p.m. when I refresh her Facebook page and see it. A brand new album of photos. My heart snaps like a twig. There are 43 pictures and the album has a name. Coney Island in the Rain. Ah. The first picture is just the rain. A thundering downpour. The kind where your mom makes you wear a rain slicker. I feel young for thinking that. Inexperienced. I click through the pictures, and she wasn't there alone. There was someone else with her, another person taking photos of her being silly, jumping in puddles. She's wearing a poncho you buy near the subway, and she stomps and smiles and flips the bird at the raindrops, at the camera. She sticks her tongue out, too, impish. My heart aches with envy. It's a guy. It has to be. If she had been there with a friend, she would have insisted they take turns. She would have shared pictures of the friend stomping in the puddles. Only a boyfriend would be so invisible. A boyfriend who came into the picture the night she fainted. I can feel it. She was fired up by the storm, the romance of it all. There are so many pictures because everything in the world looked new to her that day. This is how I felt in New York. Except I was there alone. I was imagining being there with her, and here she is, actually being somewhere with someone. She's dazzled by every little magic thing, the raindrops landing on the candy carnival games, a custodian standing under the overhang, doing his job, waiting. The pictures are uneven with the colors, overexposed. It means you showed too much, and you shared too much, and you can't take it back. The rain stops, and there's a time-lapse video of the clouds morphing into a sky that says, "Sure, walk around. I won't give you any trouble. No more rain, I promise." The next pictures are at a restaurant in the city that overlooks the river. There are lights everywhere, little candles flickering. I backtrack to make sure I didn't miss anything, but then it hits me. They didn't take pictures during their trip back to the city because they were kissing. Kissed. Fixed. In the restaurant, Chloe raises her eyebrows as she eats the spaghetti. She rests her chin in the palm of her hand. Her eyes look bigger than they are in real life, and she is watching a performance, a song. Her lips are puffy. Kissed. Fixed. She is sitting still, but really she's falling. Away from me, into someone else. It feels like I did this. Like I never should have gone to see her, as if I made this happen. The last picture of her is black and white. Underneath it says, #TryBackChloe. Then she's gone. She changes the setting on all her accounts to private. The window is closed. You can't see where she's going or what she's doing unless you're friends with her, which means she isn't like the person stranded on the desert island anymore, making words out of branches on the beach, hoping I'll see from above. She is behind closed doors, somewhere in Tribeca, with him. Him. I still don't know who he is. Before she went private, her friends would say things like, "You guys are too cute," and "So happy to see you, so happy." Her friends met him, but they didn't say his name. He lives somewhere high up, like a bad guy in a comic book. He has his own patio in the sky. Sometimes she took pictures of what you see when you're up there, things you can only see from up in his #penthouse. She's different with him. There are more jokes, more hashtags. I don't know where he lives exactly, but his home is the opposite of my basement dwelling. My walls are concrete and cold and dark orange. But in his apartment, the walls are white and there are wooden beams overhead. She isn't painting as much. There aren't any new pieces for sale on her site, and she hasn't announced any more gallery appearances. Sometimes I think the guy she's dating is a doctor, that she met him because of me, because I made her faint. I bet he told her to take a break from painting. So she did. Because he's a doctor and doctors know what's best. In my nightmares, I sense him on my tail. He shadows me, resuscitating all the innocent people I murdered. He is hunched over them, counting, pumping his hands on their chests. And then I wake up. Alone. Aware that he presses his mouth into hers. His dick. That he sits with her on the subway train. I've never even been on the subway. I went all the way to New York City and I never got on. Days on Coney Island. Nights under the stars. On bridges lit up from above. If he's not a doctor, he might be a famous actor. I look at the screenshots I saved from when her Facebook was open. I look until I can't take it anymore. I read about how Facebook makes people want to kill themselves, and then before you know it, I'm hungry, or it's time to go to work. Your body gets in the way of your plans, your life. Like that thing Lovecraft said about how you can always kill yourself next year. I take another break from my route, from the Kiwis, from Flory's emails. I think about Roger's letter. You have power. You're welcome. I am powerful, in a way. But it's a misleading word. The power isn't mine. I'm full of it, but I may as well be dead. I'm not in control of anything. I'm a host for an evil force. Powerless. I could only kiss Crane Camaflori because I could never love her. She doesn't get under my skin. Everyone I've ever hurt, they've gotten to me in one way or another. I could drive my car into the ocean like in the Pixies song. A couple of times I go to Bristol, over the bridges, the dramatic arches. I think of driving off, but I can't do that to the rescue workers, to the fish, to my parents. And of course I can't give up, not fully. Can't imagine dying without ever having gotten to take a picture of Chloe in the rain. My phone buzzes, a text from my boss. Theo, kid, your break is over. I need you tonight. I write back, sure. It's a bad day on the road. I wasn't off for that long, but there are new subscribers, hard houses to find. There are bushes in the way of the street numbers. I finally get to Crane Camaflori Street, and I roll down the window to read a hot pink sign on a utility pole. Have you seen this cat? His name is Muse Frontman. He is my heart. I roll up the window. There's a note for me in Flory's box. It would be so much cooler if you men had the courage to say goodbye. Goodbye. While I'm reading her note, her screen door opens. She sees me. She's coming for me. Her robe is open, and underneath she wears little shorts and a little shirt. She's coming closer, and her boobs are there, as close to me as the raindrops are to Chloe when she bends over, when she makes them her own. She gives me the finger. I deserve it. She goes inside, slams the door. I could park the car and apologize, try and kiss her again. But I love Chloe. I push the gas, but then something hits my car. Clash! A mug. A plastic mug that rolls onto the ground. Brown University. She threw her mug at me. She is starting to cry, holding on to her cat's leash. I stop the car. My heart is calm, steady. I get out and walk toward her, and she toughens up. Says I had no right to ghost her. I apologize. She looks around. Not here, she says, leading me into her place. I could leave. I should leave. I'm not kissed. I'm not fixed. I can't stop thinking about how instantaneous it was with Chloe. It's the opposite with Flory. She isn't fainting, bleeding. She is wrapping her leash around her wrist, telling me about how she can't find her cat. She doesn't know how to get under my skin, and she never will. I put my arms around her, and she doesn't fight. She says she missed me. As fucked up as that is, I really did. I really thought we had a connection. Me too, I lie. She pulls away and leads me away from the fish, toward the kitchen. It smells so bad, and I try to hide it. I'm sorry, she says. I have to clean the litter box, but I read you shouldn't do that because the scent is home, and if I throw it out, he might not find his way. I hold her hand. He'll come home, I say. He has you. She laughs. I can tell she's been crying a lot. It's gross, you know? What you can get used to when you live alone. She turns off lights and checks the cat door, feeds her fish. She says she went back on Zoloft when I ghosted her, when Muse ran off. You guys, she says, you have no idea what you do to us. You girls are the same way. She tilts her head. Do you mean that? Because you can't use me right now. I don't want you here unless you mean that. I get a flash of Chloe and Dr. Actor. I push them away. I'm here. Crane, comma, Flory shakes her head. Don't do that. Don't do what? Don't think about someone else when you're in my home. I'm not. Don't lie. Just don't do it. I mean, when you start to do it, just stop. She tears her top off, and her tits are there for the world to see. The world, as in me. Just me. This is me, she says. I'm comfortable with who I am. Don't ghost me. Don't zone out on me. I don't need you, but I like you. Okay, I say, moving toward her. Still, she doesn't bleed, doesn't weaken. She pats my chest. Follow me, she says. I follow her into the bedroom and she asks me to close the door. The walls are white and the bed is messy and it's almost like a hospital room. No fish, no art. I realize that was all for strangers, for visitors. This is where she lives, where she worries, where she takes her pants off and comes toward me, opening herself up to me, kissing me. I kiss her like we did before. She doesn't stop me when I feel her boobs. Her skin goes all over me, her mouth moving into mine. She is so slow and velvety, syrup and turtles and old men in rocking chairs. All the slow things in the world. The roots, all of them in her, moving toward me. I want her. I feel her. I let the want take over. And then, she stops kissing me. She stops breathing. Drip. Drip. That bony smell. That stiffening, sinking. No, no. She seizes up as her eyes bulge. No, no. As her hands crunch bone to muscle. This is what it looks like when you die. The ugliest thing there is. The way the neck extends. She is a turtle. And then she's jelly. Wobbling. All that energy exiting. Swoosh, vroom. Gone. And the horror of the quiet. The thud. When her body falls onto her bed. I killed her. Because that's what I do. I open the bedroom door, and it hits me all at once. The fish. I run from tank to tank, and some are living and some are dead, but the dead aren't dead because fish die, like she said. Not today. The dead are dead because of me. The smell. I open the closet in her kitchen, the one you can't get to without moving the trash, the recycling. I push my way in there and move the old coats, the magazines, the umbrellas. And there he is, dead. Muse. I killed him too, when I kissed her. I wasn't kissed, fixed. Flory wasn't immune to me, and this has nothing to do with passion. I was deluding myself, and now more life is lost because of me. Flory, her sweet little cat in the window, dead. Flory never knew what I put her through, that I risked her life, that I did what I told myself I wouldn't do. I experimented on a human. What Roger did to me. You are what you eat. And I caved. She didn't sign a form. She didn't sign up for this, and she never will know. And she was right about all of it. You guys, you have no idea what you do to us. I go back into the bedroom and cry with her because she should know. Her body should get my tears. I tell her how sorry I am. On her nightstand, there are pills. Poor Flory. There are bags from CVS with instructions stapled on them. Sleeping Beauty is on TV, muted. Pills didn't kill her. I did. Because I should know by now, once and for all, and end all the daydreams about tomorrow, about getting cured. I should get it already. I am a monster. I am evil. I am Providence, and she was keeping Providence weird. And I killed her. When I die, if there is a place called hell, I will go there.
Eggs. Some girls make you think about that Bruce Springsteen line, "You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're all right." That's my kind of woman. Grainy skin, a ready smile, eyes that could stand to be a little bigger. Same goes for the mouth, as opposed to her feet. Those could stand to be a little smaller. But a woman like that sets her eyes on you, the world opens up and sucks you in. It's a sex thing. A life thing, a thing you only get from that woman at that moment. That's what I thought about Lo when we got together. That's what I think about this poor girl, this dead girl. Flory Susan Crane. Some people, you take one look at them and you just like them. I like her parents for giving her the middle name of Susan. I feel for the girl. I know what happened. She couldn't find her cat, Muse Frontman, according to the neighbors, the signs. She was missing him bad, and then she found him in the closet. There are pills here, bottles open. But this girl in a great big T-shirt, the bottoms of her feet are brown with mud, gravel. Why was she outside with her bare feet? She was looking for her cat. My gut flip-flops. I radio Stacy. Be right there. Dropped my phone under the bed. Something tells me this girl didn't put on this shirt. There's a drawer in her chest open, as if someone didn't close it all the way. This is crazy, Eggie. This is suicide. Don't make it yours. I get a closer look at her face. Her skin is bare, her pores pronounced. But there are fake singular eyelashes in there, pressed in recently. You can tell, I know from my sleeping wife, and you don't put those in for nobody. She painted her eyelids, nude, as Lo says. You work hard to look like you didn't work hard. The skin around her lips is the slightest bit raw. She's been kissed, and my gut twists. She wasn't just kissed. Whoever kissed her, he has a beard. I catch my breath. What was he doing here? Now isn't the time to question myself for asking the question, for attempting to be logical, to prove that there aren't thousands of men out there with beards. Now I am here on the scene. Now is the time for my mind to make leaps. The chewing gum ground into the tiles in her kitchen, the fish that weren't fed, the water that wasn't changed, the pills, the dates on the bag, filled this week, recently. He was here until he wasn't. That's why her skin wasn't used to him, the way Lowe's got used to mine when I had a beard. That's crazy, Eggie. No, it's makeup. Makeup. When Chucky was two, when he wasn't looking at us, wasn't smiling, was just banging his head against the wall, Lo threw all her makeup in the trash. It's nothing but poison, she said, nothing but chemicals. Back then she was on my side. We were trying to beat this thing together, the thing they call autism. I remember how astounded I was by what that makeup did. Without it, Lo had no eyelashes at all, and without those eyelashes, her eyes were even smaller. I didn't say anything, but sometimes she'd catch me staring at her. I wanted her to go back to wearing the mascara, and really, wasn't it too late? Chucky was no longer inside of her. But here's the thing about love. When you want to make someone better, when you love someone, you do everything, anything, even if it's crazy. And then one day, Lo came downstairs and her eyes were lined again. Her lashes were back. In the living room, I hear the medics calling this a coronary possible self-inflicted, pending autopsy. This girl died of a heart attack, and nobody wonders about a dead cat. Florrie Susan Crane was only 23. The odds of a young female of average weight dropping dead at that age? Less than 1%. Odds of my Chucky being so violent that they have to keep him in a room with padded walls? Less than 1%. But odds don't matter. Not when it's your daughter. Your son. She wrote to her boss a few hours before she passed. She's a paralegal and she was calling in sick. Florrie sure did like her email. There are thousands of unread messages, most of them from men. You can tell that none of these guys loved her, not in the right way. There's a tone of, thanks for writing again, but I still don't love you. Try again next week. The most recent guy she was talking to is named Theo Ward. It was a one-way street situation. She was writing to him. It was so much fun hanging out with you, even if I shouldn't say that. Because of you, I am watching Grown-Ups too. Okay, it just hit me. I'm watching the second movie before the first. Blasphemy. Here's another podcast I meant to tell you about. Lenny Fader would approve. Theo, sometime we have to watch Grown-Ups 2 together. But Theo Ward wasn't responding to her. I looked through her account, and this is true of most of these shitheads she was talking to. They drop off the planet. She gives and they go. Lowe's kids call it ghosting, but really it's just being a shithead. The last thing she printed was an article about Sex Drive and Zoloft. The last thing she did in the world, she went outside and got her paper. I saw it in the living room, but she didn't bring it back to bed. Why go out and get it? Why get your feet dirty? The last purchase, insofar as I can tell, books. A bag on the floor. A receipt from yesterday. My heart stops when I look in the bag. Lovecraft. Yes, her shelves are stuffed. Vonnegut and Jane Austen, DeLillo. She's got a lot of Italo Calvino, a few by Colleen Hoover. But what did she buy yesterday? The last day of her life? Lovecraft. The beard. The hat. I am Providence. What do you do when someone lets you down? You investigate. What makes them tick? What do they love and why? I'll get Lovecraft, she thought. Maybe then I can figure him out. I feel it in my gut, and it's the great cockeyed injustice of the system. You can know something beneath your bones in your intestines, and you can't do anything about it. I'm out of time, and I amble into the kitchen where I play along. Yep, this is a sad one, poor girl. No mystery. In a corner by the overflowing trash can, there are crumbs swept together, as if she couldn't work out how to get them off the floor and into the can. Single people don't have to be neat for anyone. In my gut, she was scrambling to make things nice for the beard. I open her cabinets, but I feel Stacy's eyes bore into the back of my head. The girl's mother will be here, a mother who doesn't need to see some plainclothes cop sniffing around for no reason, when there's no malfeasance, no forced entry, no nothing. The mother has already sobbed on the phone, already said she was worried to death about her daughter who just couldn't seem to find her way and never saw a drug she didn't want to take. My gut won't quit. It burns. I fake a yawn. I riffle through her mail. Stacy coughs. I apologize. Sorry, boss. But then she leaves. I keep going, digging through her magazines, her old newspapers. Sometimes she didn't even take them out of the bag. I wonder why she subscribes. But then I think of that poster in her living room. Keep Providence weird. I like this girl. I do. We're clearing the kitchen, and I hear the clack-clack of the gurney. Stacy's whistling at me. Let's go, Eggy. Outside, it's a madhouse. The whole neighborhood is up, alarmed. The conclusion is that Mother Nature is a capricious beast. This girl wasn't a junkie. Florrie was independent, and this is just tragic. Stacy keeps her distance, says people need to blame someone. Sure, I say, agreeable. But I gotta honor my gut. Gonna get an aspirin in my car, I say. She nods. She believes me, and I am free to go, free as a kid whose mother left him alone. I watch the neighbors stand around. Most of the houses on this street are old Vicks with chipped paint, split into duplexes, occupied by smart people, well-to-do people, people we used to call yuppies. And most of these people subscribe to the Projo. More than half the houses have the white plastic box at the end of the driveway. I pretend that my phone is ringing. I pretend that I have to take it. I start walking east, pretending to be into it with Lowe. Well, tell them we can't pay up front, and what I'm really doing is checking the boxes. The people. Everyone east of here who has a box appears to have a paper. I heave and stop. I do my best bewildered. Lowe, you have to calm down. You can't get worked up. You know that doesn't solve anything. I catch Stacy's eye and wave my hands, helpless, and she nods. I walk in the other direction, west. The next house after Florrie's, there's an old biddy out front shaking her head, lashing out in a whisper. That girl ran around in a bra. I always thought she was a little off. I say goodbye to imaginary Lowe, and I put my phone in my pocket. Ma'am, can I ask you, did you get your paper today? As a matter of fact, I did not, she says, unless your people stole it. Jackpot. I go to the next house. A couple of guys, one tall, one short. One of them's bouncing a baby. Their Projo box is empty, and I point at the box. No paper today? The short one glances at the box. I guess not, he says. I just can't believe it about Florrie. I stop to be there, to be good. I hear you. She seems like a good kid. She was the best, he says. She's the reason we got the paper in the first place. A year ago, we had her over for dinner, and she got us all worked up about the importance of local news and newspapers and paper, and the tall one wraps his arm around the short one, and the baby drools happily, oblivious. I smile at the little nipper. Gorgeous kid you got there, I say. And your gut is real. That's a thing you can live your life by, that you'll do what you know is right even when people shake their heads at you, even when they think that you need sleep and aspirin. I had a hunch. I followed it. And now I have a lead. A real one. The last paper delivered went to Florrie. The paper boy stopped after he hit her house. Something went on in there. She knew the paper boy. And I'll bet he had a beard. I'll find out soon, because now all I have to do is find him.
Chloe. I never knew I could be this girl in a robe, slithering around a penthouse, opening French doors that lead out onto the terrace, and then closing the door behind me, as if this is my home, as if this is me, biting my lip, as if it's wrong to smile, wrong to savor this view. I was a shed girl back in the day. I sat on the ground with John. I agreed that it was nice to be so close to the earth, that it was nice to be snug, contained. Now I walk to the edge and I look down at New York. I never saw it like this, not from someone's home, not in a nighty. I think of that stupid hashtag Carrig came up with the other night. Hashtag Triba Chloe. How he made me post it. How he makes me cringe that way. His dorky sense of humor. His puns. But it is nice to be held. Known. To wake up in silk sheets. To splash water on my face in a bathroom with two sinks. This is pretty much my first boyfriend since, well, Carrig. I mean, I still love John. I do. But there's alchemy. Now I have this place, my boyfriend's place. It's the penthouse. It wouldn't be possible for John to get up here. There's the security, the doorman. It's the first time in my life that I'm out of reach, genuinely. Except for those times I was in an airplane. But then every flight I've ever been on, I walked the corridor at least twice, checking every seat, looking for him. And now I'm fucking the paint out of myself. Literally. I've never had this much sex, and it cuts away the need to paint. Already I got a yeast infection like some girl in a rom-com. Already I've flaked on two commissions. I feel like one of those girls you overhear in Bloomingdale's and Soho. A girl living for dresses. I feel like I'm coming into my own. And it turns out my own is this new relationship. This view. Not John, after all. It's the little things that seal the cracks in your heart. On our first real date, Carrig ordered tuna tartare, and he pronounced it tuna tartar. And I told him he was doing it wrong, and he blushed and said he's always had a feeling he was doing it wrong, but he thought it was a choice, like the way you can say tomato or tomato. I told him he was being stupid. Do you ever hear anyone say tomato? He blushed so hard. Yes, he said. Frank Sinatra. Suddenly, Carrig was an adult to me. Someone who knew about Frank Sinatra. Someone who went to college. Who had changed. Someone who had experiences about which I knew nothing. I wanted to learn. He told me about BU, about stocks and bonds. He wanted to know everything about me, and he was unable to control himself from gazing into my eyes, lifting me up on the street outside the restaurant, telling me directly, "I want you so much it hurts." I know he'll give me a key soon. And maybe someday, a ring. A baby. It's weird. To think of yourself as this whole other person, this girl who doesn't have intimacy issues, this girl who really can have it all, the art, the boyfriend, the love. I think that's why it's working so well. I didn't know until that first night just how badly I wanted to love someone. I always used to flinch so easily. I said it was my nerves, my artistic temperament, this ancient twitch from waiting for John to come back. But I'm calmer now. Sturdier. Like a table in a restaurant that shakes until you get down on your knees and wedge a napkin between the floor and the leg. And of course, it's normal that I come out here and cry when I'm alone. Of course, it's sad to know that it's not turning out how I thought. How I wanted. Me and John. Change hurts. And care gets it. We only have one rule, and it's unspoken. We don't talk about John. I hear the front door open. My boyfriend is home, tossing the mail on the counter, calling out for me. Babe, you hear? I got Chinese. And I'm drying my eyes. All the sadness dissipates. It really does. It blows my mind. It fills my soul. The smell of garlic sauce, a boyfriend's kiss, hot food I didn't have to order myself. This is why I had to make all my social media private. I don't want John to know how good I feel up here, where missing him is easier because he can't find me, because the sauce is so good. The sex, the view, the aftermath of the meal, flopping into the bed, silk sheets, twisted, laughing, togetherness. I need this. I think in the gallery that night, I didn't know it, but I think I was so lonely, so John sick. I think I was about to die.
Eggs. Back at the station, I listened to a voicemail that came in while I was on the road. The doctor's office, all over me to reschedule my annual physical. Yeah. Growing old is not for the weary. Aches and pains in your gut, that's par for the course. Are you taking your Zantac? Are you cutting back on spicy foods? I get a text from Lo. Just a picture. A picture of a letter from the doctor following up on my cancellation. No words, just a purple devil emoji. I write back, sorry, I know. She writes back, reschedule now. But I can't do that because I have a lead. A lead. I start with a phone call to the circulation department at the Providence Journal. They farm out the delivery to a company based elsewhere. So now I'm on the horn to them, pushing the buttons, trying to get a human. I finally do get a human, and she's responsive and smart. Things are going my way. She emails me a list of their contracted delivery people, and whammo, I have a name. I have the name of the man who delivers newspapers to Florrie Susan Crane Street. He lives in a house less than 10 minutes away, and yes, he has a beard. I tell Stacy that I have to go. Doctor's appointment. Lo will have my head if I don't get a physical. She gives me the thumbs up, says she's happy to see me taking care of myself. It's all I can do to stop myself from whistling, making promises to the world, how the sun is brighter outside than it was yesterday. The new world. The good world. I promise to go see Chucky. I promise to get my annual physical, and I promise to pick up flowers for my wife for no reason. I'm a new man. A good man. I found the beard. And now I'm gonna go get him. When I get to the rundown house in East Providence, I take a minute to sit and stare. By the looks of it, a few kids live here. 3, maybe 4. The amount of old toys in the yard, if you can call it that, the crabgrass, 2 dead cars with the hoods open. I step out of the car and slam the door. I'm walking through the busted gate and there is trash on the lawn and there is trash in the trash, cigarette butts in plastic cups, cups crumbled, stuffed into Wonder Bread bags, empty packs of cigarettes, crushed. Everything here is crushed or crumbled, and I hesitate at the front of the house because if I step onto the front porch, it might fall in. I press the buzzer, but of course that doesn't work. I knock on the door, and a woman moans. We don't want any. I knock again. She groans. She's coming. And when she opens the door, the inside of the house is a perfect match to the exterior. Crushed. Crumbled. She is smaller than I expected, almost elfin, short hair and pointy ears and teeth that have been whittled down by crack, jeans, something. You know you can't just show up, she says. Even the website that never works says you gotta ask permission and give me notice. I know my rights. You don't got any right coming into my fucking home. It's an unfair world for a woman like this, no doubt born to shitty people, then chastised. She's defensive. I can practically hear her crowing at some dive bar. If there were jobs that pay better than welfare, I'd get one. I know this woman. I respect where she's coming from, and I speak her language. The first decision with a woman like this is whether she's ma'am or miss. Miss, I say because there's no ring on her finger, because I'm sure she's much younger than she looks. I'm not social services.
Thank Christ.
I'm a cop. I say cop because that's what a girl like her would call a guy like me. And I'm not here to harass you about what goes on in your home. Hell no.
Well, good, she says, because I haven't done anything wrong. But my piece of shit neighbor, on the other hand,
I cut her off, hard. I'm looking for Vernon Tully. She rolls her eyes.
Well, come on in, she says. We can wait together.
He does live here, yes.
Fuck if I know,
she shrugs. You could call it that. Or you could call it dis-a-fucking-peers for 6 months and leaves me with his kid that isn't even mine. But he's still supporting you. You're cashing his checks, no problem. She flares up, nostrils out.
That's not fair.
Her jaw shakes.
Don't you start with me. I get the job done. The money should be mine. You think he delivers those papers? I deliver those papers. Only thing that motherfucker delivers is dis-a-fucking-pointment.
My gut freezes up. You personally deliver those papers? She straightens.
My crew, she says. My guys.
Relief. You got names of these guys? W-2s? Inside, a baby cries. She is rattled.
I pay them all under the table, but I suppose you don't care. I suppose you're going to arrest me for trying to feed my fucking kids.
The best part of being a cop is when you don't arrest the woman for feeding her kids, when you get to tell her that you get it, that you know about the pain of being a parent.
Thank you, she says. I got names. Hang on.
She's in the living room, finding notepads, tossing notepads.
The list is somewhere, she says. It didn't grow feet and walk out of here like Mr. Shit for Brains.
Take your time. Hurry up. She looks at me.
My guys all seem good,
she says.
What is this even?
You have to love someone for loving others. I groan, play along. We got an old biddy. She's not getting her papers. She's worked up. It's nothing. She huffs.
And this is my tax dollars at work, she says. Nice.
She's over on Power Street. You know how they are.
Why didn't you just say when you got here?
She asks.
That's Theo's run.
Theo. Florey's emails. Theo Ward. My heart might exit my chest.
Fucking Theo, she says. Pain in my ass, always mopey and quiet and shit. Gives me a fucking headache, that kid, literally.
That's Theo Ward, right? She rolls her eyes, nods.
Yeah, she says, fucking Theo.
Theo Ward. It's all worth it for the feeling when you're about to get what you want, when the waitress is headed your way, when your gut was right. Yes. This Theo, does he have a beard? She nods, groaning.
And you should tell him to trim the fucking thing every once in a while. It's like he's got bugs growing in there.
You got a phone number? She writes it in her notepad. The beard. The beard. I push on. More. More. Do you have an address for him?
He's out in North Providence, she says. Off Benjamin, on Spicer, 52. I remember because I gave him so much shit about living on a street called Spicer. He didn't laugh. The kid has no sense of humor. Glum.
Anything else I should know?
I don't know his sign, officer.
Anything physical? Say it. Say it.
He always wears this stupid hat, she says. I am Providence. I mean, We all live here, right? Get the fuck over it.
In my car, I'm putting Spicer into the GPS, and all I can think of is that Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. I'll get that book for Chucky, and I'll go to Bradley and read it to him, even if he can't follow it. I did it. I found the beard. Theo Ward. That's a fake name if I ever heard one. And I did my homework, and I read some Lovecraft. Read about the guy. The stories are nonsense. You can't follow these made-up creatures. But the stuff they wrote about him, now that's not bad. Lowe was right about him being complicated. That's one word for it. The man was nutty, depressed, bad at taking care of his own. A complete racist. He used fake names, pen names, but it stinks of someone trying to weasel their way around the basic laws of life. The GPS lady says, start. I kick the car into gear. I start. The reason I know I found the beard is that I know where Theo Ward comes from. It comes from H.P. Lovecraft. Literally. Two of his numerous fake names were Lewis Theobald and Ward Phillips. I memorized all the fake names for no reason, for gut reasons, as if I sensed that I would be here, on my way to Spicer Street, on my way to get him, to figure out what he does. What is it, Springsteen says in that song? Pulling out of here to win. Yeah. Yeah. I'm careening down the highway, the same stretch I've been down a million times, only today it's different. Today is good. I can already see myself on a podium. Well, it started with an instinct, a gut feeling. You hear that, kids? Listen to your gut. Today I take the exit where you hit all the lights because I want to expand this moment, the moment before the moment. I don't speed. I don't rush. I feel my heart pump faster and faster. I build the suspense. I bang a right before I'm there so I can circle the block, come around through the back. I have my wits about me. I'm alive. Never been so alive. I park on the street. There's a spot for me. It's a sign. Another sign. I go east on foot toward the back of the building, your standard run-down clunker, a dumpster out back, stuffed to the gills, coming apart at the seams. There's a couple of banged-up old cars. I pass one of the cars, see the marks of a young person on the passenger seat, an iPod left out in plain sight, a hoodie. The Beard's iPod? The Beard's hoodie? The air is sweet, and someone in there must be baking a cake. There's a back door open, a screen door. A girl comes walking toward the door, a pretty girl, looking at me as I'm looking in the car. Hey, I see you, she says. She's wearing a uniform, a Tenley's uniform. I want to think that she's on her way to work, but the realization sinks in hard and fast. She's not on her way. She's at work. That's what I smell. Tenley's. Waffle cones. Fuck. Didn't mean to sneak up on you, honey. Sorry, she says. You don't seem bad, but we have a lot of scum around here. She's walking outside, lighting a butt. This is her cigarette break. This is her workplace. That other car, that person is inside, also working. And in my gut, I know the beard doesn't work in a goddamn Tenley's. He doesn't scoop ice cream, doesn't wear a white apron. He gave Tully's wife a fake address. Of course he did. She yawns and unlocks her car with the remote. You look lost, she says. My phone buzzes, low. She wants to know when I'll be home. I flash my badge and motion to the girl in the apron. 1 minute. I write back to Lowe, soonish. 1 or 2 more hours, sorry. Hey, listen, I say. Are there apartments above your shop here? She shakes her head. No, there aren't apartments above the shop. Why? She says. Are you looking for someone? I wouldn't normally be this free, but my gut is humming and my phone is buzzing. Mad low, scared gut. So I just blow my wad. You have any regulars? Maybe a guy, a taller guy, got a big beard, a hat that says, I am Providence? She shakes her head, in the way where she's sure. She doesn't even need to think about it. No, she says. Why, is there a creeper around? I saw some girl got raped a few miles away a couple weeks ago. Is it that? Nothing like that, I say. I'm dizzy. I'm dead inside. Dead end. I tell the girl I have to make a phone call, and I dial the number that's supposed to be the beard's number, but what do I get? I get nothing. I get the sounds of the end. That hollow, anonymous leave-a-message voice that means nothing to anyone. The sun's pounding on me, and the girl's cigarette is stronger than it should be. Or maybe it's the air back here. The lack of air. You got a bathroom in there I can use? She nods. Just don't let Ricky give you any trouble. Ricky? The beard? It's a pathetic thing, Hope. Hard to kill. She's really weird when it comes to cops. She. Inside the little hallway, the scent of it all overwhelms me. The sweetness. The sound of a woman up front. You can do a birthday cake same day, yeah? An ice cream cake? And do you have those candles where they're made out of numbers? I lean against the wall. Hot in my head, in my gut. The sign across from me is bright, primary colors. Frappe of the day. Fluffernutter. It should be a colon, not an exclamation point. I close my eyes. I remember Chucky's fourth birthday. The night before, I went into his room. He was smiling in his sleep. I thought, this is it. I remember the next day telling the doctor, low, gasping, why didn't you say anything to me? And I told her it was my present to her, this good news, that I wanted it to be a surprise. I remember the force of her arms around me. Love is hands holding you. But then we saw the doctor. She wasn't as excited. She said she'd make a note in his report, said it was interesting. I sat in his room every night for a week, but I didn't see his lips curl up again. And by the next checkup, I wasn't sure that I'd ever seen my boy smile. You see what you want to see, especially in the dark, especially with your kid. In the men's room, I lock the door. There's a urinal that needs to be cleaned and a standard toilet, seat up, piss all over it. Kids. But not my kid. Not the beard, either. I missed. I followed my gut, and my gut was wrong. And of course it was wrong. It's wrong all the time. It's right sometimes, yes, but all this time I blocked out all those moments when it was wrong. Chucky's birthday. That time when Stacy had to be rushed to the hospital and I was sure that she was losing the baby. Wouldn't wish that on anyone, but I felt so sure she was going to have her first brush with hell. But her baby was fine. Some people, things are fine. That's just how it is. I have failed. My gut didn't fail me. My gut did what it does. It whispered to me, gnawed at me. But it's my job to know when it's on to something, as opposed to when it's just me stretching, reaching, pleading with the universe to throw me a bone. The beard is gone, and there's no way to find him. There never was. I unzip, I unbuckle, I am undone, wrong and open, flapping in the wind, but there is no wind. There's only dank, sweet air mixing with the urine. My gut creeps up on me as I exhale, as I try to piss. Come on. It stings. It fights me. My gut falls on top of me. Plunk. My dick burns. I look down into the urinal and I see what I expected to see, what my gut said I would see. Unreliable, evil gut, just as loud when it's lying as when it's telling the truth. My gut is right this time, and something is wrong. I see blood, and it's mine. All mine.
John, I think I wanted to do this the day I moved in here. Just destroy every fucking thing, every piece of this life I never wanted, this life I was stuck with, this half-life, non-life, poison life. The futon with the goddamn sheets that came in the mail from Target, the sheets that were never as soft as I wanted them to be because I misread the description online. I shred these fucking sheets until I'm drenched in sweat, in Dunwich stench. Fuck you, Sheets. Fuck you, life. Fuck you, Roger, and fuck you, Magnus. I pick up the blender I ordered from Best Buy a night I thought I was being funny when I ordered a blender and a DVD of Blended. I thought of it as a joke present for Chloe, as if she was ever going to be in my life, as if she needed these things, as if she would have wanted them. I throw my blender at the wall, the whole of it, the glass jug, the heavy bottom. It doesn't break. Fuck you, blender! My microwave, the source of so many pathetic little meals, all the hot pockets, all the leftovers, all the things that came out of the freezer and into this little box. The things that kept me alive, as if it was worth it, as if I was ever gonna have a life. Being alive is nothing without being able to live. I pull the microwave off the counter. I let it go. Crash! Fuck you. T-shirts from UrbanOutfitters.com because I can't relax in a brick and mortar. Fuck you, painting I got from Etsy, blue and white and black brush strokes that meant something to me, the same color palette as a jar of fluff. I gut the canvas with a knife. Fuck you, art. In the end, you only made me think of her even more. Chloe, the more I destroy, the more aware I am of the fire in me. The rage I've been quieting for so long. I kill all this stuff because it's all his in the end. He made me this way, a hermit with a never-ending stream of packages at the top of the stairs. I break these things because I can't break Roger. You're welcome, he said. I've held so much in for so long, ever since I tucked the Dunwich whore into my back pocket. I played the part of basement boy for my mother, for TV. I let everyone think I'm proof that there's a silver lining, that something good came out of all this, that Roger Blair didn't win because I'm fine, a picture of health. But it ends today. Today I'm done waiting. Today I find meanie. I grab my keys. I have never made it up the stairs this fast, ever. Meanie isn't home, but I see his wife, Sadie. She's plopped on a cushy sofa in their den. Mother's Day is muted on their giant TV. Sadie's eyes are glued to her phone. She's mom soft in her plush robe with her readers perched on the tip of her broad pink nose. She's home alone, but she's surrounded by people. There are framed pictures on the walls of her kids, their vacations to Fiji, their little grandbaby, their great big life. The kind of life I can't have. There's an open bottle of wine breathing on her coffee table. She has white, fuzzy slippers, and the left one is missing a little bow. I take a picture of her. I take another, a close-up on her slippers. I log into my Peter Fader email, and I attach the pictures. That one of the missing bow should do it. I know it's risky. Meanie could forward my threat to the police. But I've watched him enough to know that he does love his wife. And I know what I would do in this situation if someone threatened to hurt Chloe. I would do whatever I could to save her. My words are cold, direct. You have 10 minutes or your wife is a dead woman. Call this number now, or she goes the way of the bow. My phone rings. I finally have Meanie on the phone. and now he's cold, direct. Who are you, and what do you want? I don't answer right away. He is rattled, whispering and walking. I can hear you breathing, goddammit! Dr. Meany, it's very simple. I need you to tell me where I can find Roger Blair. Well, he says, it's very simple. I don't know. Now who the hell is this? Yes, you do. And if you don't tell me, I'm going to murder your wife. Bullshit, he snarls. Roger, I know it's you. You're using a machine to deepen your voice, but only you would do this to me. I send him a picture of the movie, Julia Roberts in her funny wig. The last thing your sweet Sadie will ever see. He is fuming now. If you are in cahoots with Roger Blair... We did good work down here, John. We are not in cahoots. Not now, not ever, and I will not lose my cool. I go again. Where is Roger? He says no. He says I don't want to find Roger. The man is a sick person. I huff. That's quite a way to talk about your best friend. There's a long pause, and then he says it. My name. John? I screwed up. I don't know how, but he knows. My skin crawls. I try not to tremble. Tell me where he is, or I will kill her. John, he says, I know you've been through hell, but I was not in on this. Now let's calm down a minute. I'm on your side here. I tried to warn people, I just... Let's talk about this. I don't like his voice. I don't like him. He's patronizing. I tell him Sadie looks sleepy, and that gets to him, and he snarls, What do you fucking want? It's weird when a teacher swears. Any teacher. I tell him I want to know what Roger did to me. He says he has no idea. And now it's easy. I've seen you on TV. You always have an idea. He sighs. Have you ever heard of something called apical dominance? No. A tree doesn't just randomly grow tall with one central branch. The central branch fights the others to become what it is. Nothing is arbitrary about power. The branch with apical dominance grows more strongly than the others, which in turn establishes them as weak. The dominant branch is stronger because the others are weak. And then he starts lecturing me. It's a long-winded story, a lot of science. He says plants have brains, that they make choices. I already know from the videos that the daughter vine is Roger's favorite. Meany says it's the Dracula of the food world. It has 72 hours to find food or it dies. The daughter literally sucks the light out of the tomato plant. It's murder. It's practical. Meany says there is no emotion in the plant world. There is only survival. I jot down a few words. Energy transfer. Daughter vine. He tells me about other plants that release toxins when they're under attack. He tells me about Roger's idea that humans might be able to do this sort of thing. He says the whole notion of people transferring energy, vampiric communication, is categorically absurd because we are not plants. We can't do that. And inside, I think. But we did. We do. I do. He can't help me because he doesn't think it worked. I have no use for him. I need Roger. Magnus. I see Mrs. Meany on the sofa. Her new glass of wine. A picture of his kids by the TV. Tell me where I can find Roger. I can't make you any promises, Meany says. But there is a house in Lynn. Chloe and I were in Lynn once, almost. It was a school field trip, and Chloe was fighting with Noelle and Marlene, which meant that she wanted to sit with me on the bus. I can still see her flowery dress. I can hear Mrs. Reardon, her voice going up 100 octaves. A Lily Pulitzer at your age. Wow, must be nice. We passed a sign for Lynn, and all the windows were open and everyone on the bus was chanting, Lynn, Lynn, the city of sin, you never come out the way you went in. I remember Chloe's eyes when she looked at me. I wish they would stop, she said. This is where our fluff comes from. It was the most beautiful thing she'd ever said to me. Our fluff. I wanted us to float off the bus and go in there together, but kids aren't allowed inside the fluff factory. It's too dangerous. Lynn, Lynn, the city of sin. So far it doesn't feel so full of sin here. This part of Lynn is cushy. He lives out by the Breakheart Reservation. Technically, his house is in Saugus. On the map, you can see the hiking trails nearby, places to go fishing. I live in hell, and Roger Blair goes hiking. I turn onto his street, and for the first time in my life, I worry my heart is so hot it could kill me. It's so damn nice here. His house is offensively cheery with blue shingles and white shutters. There's a sign on the front door. Life's a beach. I don't look both ways when I cross his empty street. It isn't fair that he gets to live like this. I don't use the little brick walkway that leads to his front door. I march across his lawn, his freshly mowed grass. Bastard. I yank the storm door open. I almost take it off the hinges. I breathe. Cool your jets, John. Cool your jets. I don't want him dead. I need his help. I fix my eyes on a blue lantern he put on the porch. The man who bashed me over the head and put me to sleep. This same man went to Target or Home Depot and saw this lantern and thought, hey, that would look nice on my porch. I close the storm door. Thankfully, it's not a screen door. It's the perfect barrier. He must know what I can do. He won't open the storm door. We can have a conversation without my heart attacking him. At least, not right away. I knock twice, like a mailman, like a neighbor. In the distance, I hear an ice cream truck and a siren, the sounds overlapping. I knock again, but no one comes, and no neighbors step out to ask if they can help me because this neighborhood is the kind where people live in their backyards, not on their front porches. An hour later, I wake up in my car. There's a fight at a house down the street, an uneven battle between a man and a woman. The man kicks the lady and she tumbles out of the front door, spinning like a child. He throws a little plastic bag of dope at her and she's flailing, running after the bag. He kicks her again from behind. She falls hard, grabs the little bag before slipping into a car. And then she's gone and he slips back into his house. I can see his teeth from here, his smile. He's laughing. It happened fast, and I can't let go of it. I've never seen anything like that in real life. To think of how I felt so sorry for myself when Carrig teased me, but to compare it to this, a man against a woman? The guy I just saw? That guy is a real monster. I remember asking Dr. Wu if you could turn Wilbur human. If you can make the human part of the person overtake the monster part. I think about the guy in this house, in there now, not feeling remorseful, not regretting what he did. I slam the car door, and I'm walking over there knowing what I'm about to do, and the little kid, telegraph reading part of me, is tugging at my shirt sleeve. Are you sure? You know most people are good. But I am done forgiving people. I ring the fucking bell. Can I do this? The monster cracks the door. He's holding a gun. I can do this. I kick through the door. The strength in me. I've never been like this because the other times I was trying so hard to stop it. Who knew that it would feel good to have this power surge and fly out of me like a drop on a roller coaster? Swoosh! This is for goodness. For justice. He only has time to look at me, and then the monster is dead. His ice-blue eyes are lifeless. This is so different from all the other times. There is no crying, no pulling out my hair. There is peace. I turn off his horrible music. I notice his sweating can of beer. He won't sip it again, won't beat another woman. And that's because of me. Because of what I can do. Because of the way I can help. This drug-dealing abuser has a Thanksgiving feast spread out all over his dining room table. Phones, empty bags, scales, and baggies. I carry the bricks like newborn babies into the bathroom. There's a satisfying sound when the bags pop, snap. The dope falls into the toilet. It's hard to believe this stuff can kill you. I think of all the kids who won't be overdosing. And I know I've done something good here. I remember my mom when she got home from her first day at TJ Maxx. It feels so good to have a purpose, she said. She was right. It does. A couple days later, there's an obituary for Warren W. Schmidt in the Boston Herald. He was 22. His record included 41 arrests. He had drug dens all over the city, and he had been accused of rape 3 times. There was no previous heart condition, but his death was due to a massive coronary. It's not like I'm happy. I came here to find Roger, but he hasn't stepped foot in or out of that little blue-shuttered house. I can't be with Chloe. I may never get to have that kind of life, the love kind. But it never occurred to me that I might be able to do something with my life. And I never felt it like I did today. How different it was to be at the wheel. Like a captain instead of cowering in fear in the basement. I can kill people, but I can also save them.